mystery, drama, and fiction.
Berenice by Edgar Allan Poe. Read by Michael Robert Brown. Misery is manifold. The wretchedness of earth is multiform. It overreaches the wide horizon as does the rainbow, its hues as various as the hues of that arch, as distinct and yet as intimately blended. Overreaching the wide horizon as the rainbow, how is it that from beauty I have derived a type of unloveliness? From the covenant of peace, a simile of sorrow. But as in ethics evil is a consequence of good, so out of joy is sorrow born. The memory of past bliss is the anguish of today, and agonies have their origin in the ecstasies which might have been. My baptismal name is Aegeus. That of my family I will not mention. Yet there are no towers in the land more time-honoured than my gloomy, grey, hereditary halls. Our line has been called a race of visionaries, and in the character of the family mansion, the frescoes of the chief saloon, the tapestries of the dormitories, the chiselling of buttresses in the armoury, and even more in the gallery of antique paintings, the fashion of the library, and lastly in the very peculiar nature of the library's contents, there is more than sufficient evidence to warrant the belief. The recollections of my earliest years are connected with that chamber and with its volumes, of which I say no more. Here died my mother. Herein was I born. It is idleness to say that I had not lived before, or that the soul has no previous existence. You deny it? Let us not argue the matter. Convinced myself, I seek not to convince. There is a memory of aerial forms, of sounds musical yet sad, a memory which will not be denied. A memory like a shadow, vague, indefinite, unsteady. And like a shadow, impossible to erase while the sunlight of my reason exists. In that chamber was I born, awaking from a long night of what seemed but was not non-entity into fairyland, a palace of imagination, wild dominions of solitary thought and erudition. It is not extraordinary that I gazed around me with a startled and ardent eye, nor that I loitered away my boyhood in books and dissipated my youth in reverie. But as the years rolled away, and the noon of manhood found me still in the mansion of my fathers, it is wonderful what stagnation fell upon my life. Wonderful how complete an inversion took place in my commonest thought. The realities of the world seemed to me as visions, and only visions, while the wild land of dreams became my everyday existence, utterly and solely in itself. Berenice and I were cousins. We grew up together in my paternal halls, yet we grew differently. I, ill of health and buried in gloom, she agile, graceful, and overflowing with energy. Hers the ramble on the hillside, mine the studies of the cloister. I, living within my own heart, addicted body and soul to the most intense and painful meditation, she, roaming carelessly through life, with no thought of the shadows in her path, or the silent flight at the raven-winged hours. Berenice! I call upon her name. Berenice! And from the grey ruins of memory, a thousand tumultuous recollections are startled at the sound. Ah, how vivid is her image before me now, as in the days of her light-heartedness and joy. Oh, gorgeous yet fantastic beauty! Oh, sylph amid the shrubberies of our home! Oh, naiad among its fountains! And then all is mystery and terror, and a tale which should not be told. A fatal disease fell like the wind of Araby upon her frame, and while I gazed upon her, the spirit of change swept over her, pervading her mind and her character in a manner most subtle and terrible, disturbing even the identity of her person. Alas, the destroyer came and went, and the victim I knew no longer as Berenice. Among the numerous maladies which effected so horrible a revolution in my cousin's moral and physical being, the most distressing and obstinate was a species of epilepsy which not unfrequently terminated in a trance which resembled death, and from which her recovery was in most instances startlingly abrupt. In the meantime, my own disease, for I should give it no other name, my own disease grew rapidly upon me, hourly gaining vigour and at length obtaining over me the most incomprehensible ascendancy. This monomania, as I must term it, consisted in a morbid irritability of those properties of the mind which in metaphysical science are termed the attentive. It is more than probable that I am not understood, but I fear that it is not possible to convey an adequate idea of that nervous intensity of interest with which my powers of meditation buried themselves in the contemplation of even the most ordinary objects of the universe. I mused for long, unwearied hours with my attention riveted to some frivolous device on the margin or in the topography of a book. I became absorbed for the better part of a summer's day in a quaint shadow falling aslant upon the tapestry or upon the door. I lost myself for an entire night in watching the steady flame of a lamp or the embers of a fire. I dreamt away whole days over the perfume of a flower. I repeated monotonously some common word until the sound, by frequent repetition, ceased to convey any idea whatever to the mind. Such were a few of the most common and least pernicious vagaries of the mental faculties that bade defiance to anything like analysis or explanation, and during which I lost all sense of motion or physical existence. Let me not be misunderstood. This undue, earnest, and morbid attention excited by frivolous objects must not be confused with the ruminations common to all mankind, especially indulged in by persons of vivid imagination. It was not even, as might be at first supposed, an extreme condition or exaggeration of such propensity. It was indeed essentially distinct and different. In the one instance, the dreamer, interested by some object that is seldom frivolous, imperceptibly loses sight of this object in a wilderness of deductions and suggestions until, at the conclusion of a daydream, often replete with luxury, he finds the cause of his musings entirely vanished and forgotten. In my case, the object was invariably shallow, although it assumed through my distempered vision a refracted and unreal importance. Few deductions, if any, came to me, and those few always returned to the original object as a centre. Furthermore, the meditations were never pleasurable, and at the termination of the reverie, the cause had attained a supernaturally exaggerated interest, which was the prevailing feature of my disease. My books, at the time, if they did not actually irritate the disorder, partook in their imaginative and inconsequential nature of the characteristic qualities of the disorder itself. I remember, among others, the treatise of the noble Italian Coelus Secundus Curio, De Amplitudine Beati Regni Dei, St. Austin's great work, The City of God, and Tertullian's De Carne Christi, in which appears the paradoxical sentence, "The Son of God is dead, which is credible because it is insignificant, and resurrected from the tomb, which is certain because it is impossible." A statement which occupied my undivided time for many weeks of laborious and fruitless investigation. Thus was it that, shaken from its balance only by trivial things, my reason resembled that ocean rock spoken of by Ptolemy Hephestion, which resisted all human violence and the fierce fury of the waters and the winds, and trembled only at the touch of the asphodel flower. To a careless thinker, therefore, it might appear that the alteration in Berenice, produced by her unhappy malady, would afford me many opportunities for the intense and abnormal meditation whose nature I have had some trouble explaining. Yet this was in no degree the case. In my lucid intervals, her calamity indeed gave me pain. Wounded to the heart by the tragedy of her fair and gentle life, I pondered frequently and bitterly upon the means by which so strange a revolution in her nature had so suddenly come to pass. But these reflections were unrelated to my disease, and would have occurred under similar circumstances to the ordinary mass of mankind. True to its character, my disorder revelled in the startling changes wrought in Berenice's physical frame, and the most appalling distortion it had undergone. I had never loved her during the brightest days of her unparalleled beauty. My feelings had never been of the heart, and my passions were always of the mind. Through the grey of the early morning, among the shadows of the forest at noon, and in the silence of my library at night, I had seen her not as the living and breathing Berenice, but as the Berenice of a dream, not as a being of the earth, but as the abstraction of such a being, not as a thing to admire, but a thing to analyze, not as an object of love, but as the theme of desultory speculation. Yet now, as I shuddered in her presence and grew pale at her approach, I bitterly lamented her desolate condition. I called to mind that she had loved me long, and in an evil moment I spoke to her of marriage. The period of our nuptials approached, and one afternoon in the winter of the year, on an unseasonably warm, calm, and misty day, I sat, I thought alone, in the inner apartment of the library. But as I uplifted my eyes, I saw that Berenice stood there before me. Was it my own excited imagination, or the misty influence of the atmosphere, or the uncertain twilight of the chamber, or the grey draperies which fell around her figure, that offered so indistinct an outline. She spoke no word, nor could I utter a syllable. An icy chill ran through my frame. A sense of insufferable anxiety oppressed me. A consuming curiosity pervaded my soul. Sinking back upon the chair, I remained for some time breathless and motionless as my eyes riveted upon her person. Alas, its emaciation was excessive, and not one vestige of her former beauty lurked in any line of her contour. At last, my glance fell upon her face. The forehead was high, very pale, and singularly placid. The once jet-black hair fell partially over it, overshadowing the hollow temples with ringlets of a vivid yellow that jarred discordantly with the melancholy of her countenance. The eyes were lifeless, lustreless, and seemingly pupilless, and I shrank involuntarily from their glassy stare to contemplate the thin and shrunken lips. They parted, and in a smile of peculiar meaning, the teeth of the forever changed Berenice, revealed themselves to my view. Would to God that I had never beheld them, or that, having done so, I had died. How long she stood there, I do not know. The shutting of a door awoke me from my reverie. Looking up, I found that my cousin had departed from the chamber. But from the disordered chamber of my brain, alas, the vision of her white and ghastly teeth had not departed, nor would it be driven away. There was no speck on their surface, no shade on their enamel, no irregularity in their edges that her smile had not branded upon my memory. The teeth! I saw them now in my mind more unequivocally than I had seen them with my eyes. The teeth were here, there, and everywhere, visibly and palpably before me, long, narrow, and excessively white, with pale lips writhing about them. Then came the full fury of my monomania, and I struggled in vain against its strange and irresistible influence. Surrounded by a myriad objects in the external world, I yet had thoughts for nothing but the teeth. I longed for them with a frenzied desire as all other matters became absorbed in their single contemplation. They alone presented themselves to my mental eye and became the essence of my mental life. I held them in every light. I turned them in every attitude. I surveyed their characteristics. I dwelt upon their peculiarities. I pondered upon their conformation. I mused upon the alteration in their nature. I shuddered as my imagination assigned to them a sensitive and sentient power, and even a moral expression. I believed that each of Berenice's teeth was an idea. An idea! There was the idiotic thought that destroyed me. Her teeth were ideas. That was why I coveted them so much. Only possession of my cousin's teeth could restore me to peace and bring me back to reason. The evening closed in upon me in my contemplation. The darkness came, tarried, and went. Again the day dawned, and the mists of a second night gathered round, and still I sat motionless in that solitary room. Still I sat buried in meditation, Still the spectre of the teeth maintained its terrible ascendancy as, most vivid, hideous, and distinct, they floated among the changing lights and shadows of the chamber. At length there broke in upon my dreams a cry as of horror and dismay. And then, after a pause, the sound of troubled voices, intermingled with low moanings of sorrow and pain. Only then did I arise from my seat. Throwing open one of the library doors, I saw in the antechamber a servant in tears, who told me that Berenice was no more. She had been seized with epilepsy in the early morning. Now, at the coming of night, the grave was ready for its tenant, and all preparations for the burial were completed. I found myself sitting in the library, and again sitting there alone. It seemed that I had awakened from a confused and exciting dream. I knew that it was now midnight, and I was well aware that since the setting of the sun, Berenice had been interred. But of the dreary period which intervened, I had no definite memory. Yet memory there was, replete with horror. Horror more horrible from being vague, and terror more terrible from ambiguity. There was, I knew, a fearful page in the record of my existence, written with dim, hideous, and unintelligible recollections. In vain I strove to decipher them, while, like the spirit of a departed sound, the shrill and piercing shriek of a female voice rang in my ears. I had done a deed. What was it? I asked myself the question aloud, and the whispering echoes of the chamber answered, What was it? What was it? What was it? On the table beside me burned a lamp, and near it lay a little box. I had seen it frequently before, for it was the property of the family physician. But how did it come there, and why did I shudder in regarding it? These things were in no manner to be accounted for, and my eyes at length dropped to the open pages of a book, and to a sentence underscored therein. My companions said to me, if I visited my friend's grave, I might in some way alleviate my cares. Why, as I perused these words, did the hairs of my head stand on end, and the blood of my body congeal within my veins? There came a light tap at the library door, and, pale as the tenant of a tomb, a menial entered upon tiptoe. His looks were wild with terror, and he spoke to me in a tremulous voice. What did he say? I heard some broken sentences. He told of a wild cry disturbing the silence of the night, of the household gathering together, of a search in the direction of the sound. Then his tones grew alarmed as he whispered to me of a violated grave, of a disfigured body, enshrouded yet still breathing, a body still palpitating, still alive. He pointed to my garments. They were muddy and clotted with gore. I spoke not. He took me gently by the hand and directed my attention to some object against the wall. I looked at it for some minutes. It was a spade. With a shriek, I bounded to the table and grasped the box that lay upon it. But I could not force it open. In my tremor, it slipped from my hands, fell heavily, and burst into pieces. From it, with a rattling sound, there rolled out some instruments of dental surgery, intermingled with 32 small, white and ivory-looking objects that scattered to and fro about the floor. That was Berenice by Edgar Allan Poe, adapted by Martin Foreman, and read by Michael Robert Brown.
Arbury, drama and fiction. Hear more drama and fiction, old and new, on arburyproductions.co.uk.